For anybody who may be here for the first time, I'm Erling Torsten from St. Olaf, as it says here on the, you know, on the label, and we've been doing Newsworthy Americans this week. And with the general sort of theme, although it won't be quite so prevalent today, religion and politics, but Billy Graham has been involved in one way or another in the political scene. I'll talk about that towards the end, and I'll be glad to have your response and comment on this, because, and then I'll tomorrow, to do the brief commercial here, tomorrow it's Robert Schuller, who is even less involved directly in what you call the American political scene, and he tries very hard to keep it that way. That's by design. And on the other hand, I think it's fair to say that both of these are probably two of the three or four best-known Protestant clergy in this country, and for that reason we want to give them attention and see what they tell us, not only about Billy Graham and not only about Robert Schuller, but what they tell us about, you know, about ourselves. One question I want to raise now, and you think about it for tomorrow, is a situation with Schuller that developed in Northfield. One of the Lutheran churches that happened to have been Trinity has always had church starting at 10:30. Well, if you know, in Minneapolis, out of Channel 5, Schuller comes on Sunday morning from 9:30 to 10:30. And what was happening in a few weeks after Schuller was first on, people started smiling already. The minister started to wonder why people were coming 5 to 10 minutes late, because this was the LCMS church, and, you know, Missouri never, you know, like me, never comes late. And suddenly realized people were watching even to the final benediction of Schuller, and had the motor running so they could get off. And I'm not kidding. Ask Pastor Ed Meyer, you know, Trinity Lutheran Church, he's in Winona and in Northfield, and you'll find out that that's the case. And, you know, should that be the case, then the game, you can imagine, you know, some of the older people who didn't like all the television preachers. Should we change just because we've got this new hotshot, you know, on the tube? Doesn't God start church at 10:30 in heaven anyway? Therefore we should you know, act accordingly. I haven't found a place for this. I can't see the watch today, and I don't want to be late for lunch myself. Okay. So Robert Schuller tomorrow, and today again, as with the other days, we'll truly need your response, your questions, because I've predicated this on the basis not only I don't have enough to fill us up until 40 to 12, but I really want to invite your questions after a while. Let's see, about 8 or 9. So if I have too much just for a change, I'll talk too fast. One story about that, when I first started doing these, I really enjoyed doing adult forums. Northfield is so close to South Minneapolis, there are so many ALC churches. I thought for a while I'll be able to get to all the ALC churches in South Minneapolis, and no way will that be the case, but I really enjoy adult forums. And when I was first getting started, my father went around with me. He lived just a few miles away and wanted to hear me and things, and we worked out an arrangement whereby he sat in the back where nobody else could see him except me, and when I started talking too fast, he started looking up into the ceiling. And after the first session, it took him only 2 days to get to the nearest chiropractor. That's no joke.
Time is falling, or
somebody just let me know when it's 1:45. Bunker, you can. You're appointed. Fellow Oli can help me out on that one. Okay, but with that sort of thing. Anyway, I really welcome your comments, your questions anywhere along the line. If you disagree at that point, don't wait till I'm gone. I'd be glad to entertain it. Some people will wonder why we even have a topic about Billy Graham at all. Graham is certainly the best known Protestant clergyman in the country. If not, I suppose it's fair to say he's the best known Protestant clergy leader in the world. I suppose the Pope would be the best known Catholic. Speaking of the two most significant leaders in terms of public relations in the world, some people wonder why we're even talking about Graham. He preaches the gospel. He brings sinners to a new life in Christ. Shouldn't that just about sum it up? Why even bother with some kind of assessment for this? Shouldn't we be grateful that a person such as him has been able to sustain a ministry for such a long period of time? As I'll talk about later, he really came into his own for the first time in 1949. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And now it is 1984, and he's still going strong. He'd like to retire because he has some very serious physical ailments. He's been in Rochester. I'll tell a story about that a little later. But he's still going very strong. He has simply become, as I've concluded, the most eloquent spokesman for the position he represents within Christendom. Granted, to be sure, that people like Dwight Moody, or even going back to Charles Finney, Jonathan Edwards, even Billy Sunday, some earlier American revivalist preachers, didn't have television, they didn't have radio, they didn't have the mass media, you know, track ministry or anything else. But people should say, I mean, people will say to me, why, since Graham has had this incredible influence and the remarkable position that he has, why shouldn't we simply let it go at that? In my presentation today, I don't mean to minimize his achievement at all. The Grahams, for instance, have sacrificed virtually any kind of private life other than the times they have for themselves at their home in Montreat, North Carolina. I want to tell my, I have written my notes here, my Elsie story. My sister is Elsie, and she had a whiplash that wasn't in her neck, that wasn't being helped by the ministry, I'm sorry, by the medical practice in her home in Forest City, where she was, has been and still is very active in her, in Emmanuel Lutheran Church there. And that becomes important in a minute, you know. And so she finally wound up, as so many of us do, in northern Iowa and southern Minnesota at Rochester, Mayo Clinic, and she was staying at the good old Kaler Hotel, and you know, with whiplash and some of the other things, it takes a long time for some of these things to clear up. I think Rochester must be the only city in the United States where nobody gets excited if you see people strolling up and down the sidewalks, you know, in bathrobes. They're waiting, you know, waiting for tests. 2 o'clock X-ray, 4 o'clock blood pressure, you know, and you've been some knobs right for there. Okay. Anyway, Elsie was a little restless, and we only live about 50 miles from Rochester, and so she called my mother, and my mother called me, and let's go down and have a nice dinner with Elsie. That would be fine. And so we did. We went down to the Kaler Hotel, and one doctor, she had been seeing different doctors, and one doctor had put her on Valium to relax with a whiplash thing, and another doctor had said, well, you know, if you get bored, have some friends down, have some nice, have a nice dinner, you know, have some wine with your dinner, have, you know, have a really good time. And so that's what we did. Elsie believed all these different doctors, and we went to the Elizabethan room. I remember, I still can't afford, you know, the prime rib that we had there that night. And, shouldn't laugh, it just encourages me. Okay. And we walked, we had a very nice dinner, and she was staying at the Kaler, and of course the Elizabethan room is in the Kaler. And, you know, we didn't have to drive her home or drive her to her motel or the other hotel or whatever it might be. So we simply took her to the elevator, and that was fine, and then we didn't wait for that because that was enough for goodbye. The next morning it turned out she had gotten on the elevator after having all these different things or inputs, let's say, through the evening, and she went in the elevator and it started going up. She looked around and here was Billy Graham. And she looked at him and she said, I know you, you're Walter Cronkite. It's all right, Elsie's told me I had permission to tell that story. The next time you're in Forest City, you know, say hello. All right. Anyway, the Grahams have given up, in a, you know, a great deal of you know, personal privacy and all that sort of thing. And hence, you know, I think we all are grateful for what they've been able to contribute. So let me make this assessment, which is on the surface, you know, a very pretentious thing to do. Let me make this start this assessment by asking 4 or 5 questions about his ministry, why he seems to have succeeded as he has, what seems to be the reasons for the success, where are some of the areas of some, you know, some controversy, back and forth, and then ask and invite your response as we go along. And right away with Graham, as will be the case with Schuller tomorrow, we face a very difficult question, and a question which in a very real sense can never be resolved. Because everybody has their own particular sort of style or emphasis or viewpoint on what or how one's religious faith should be, you know, should be expressed. How one should come to faith, if you want to put it in those terms. Once one is in the life of faith, how this should be expressed, where do you go with it? Everybody has, in one way or another, their own particular, as I say, lifestyle or personal interpretation of this. And the question becomes then, since this is the case, wouldn't our interpretation or our assessment or our response to Graham be as individualistic as there are as many people in here? Can we, in other words, put it the other way, can we come to any kind of sort of common ground or stand on any kind of common ground? Can we look at Graham together in any particular you know, meaningful sense? Or should we just say, well, that's the way I feel about it, And as we like to say in, you know, about the last 2-3 years, when we come up against a problem or a controversy or something else, we like to say, you know, to our friends or whomever it might be, you know, that's your problem. Have you ever thought of that? That's caught on in the last 2-3 years, just like the words awesome and some of the others have caught on. We like to say when we're stumped, that's your problem. In other words, you know, relieving ourselves of any kind of personal responsibility for what we're going to say here. But I think we can say some things. I think we can find some common ground to stand on as in looking at Billy Graham. And one place to start, and here I do it from the historian's perspective, is to see Graham, in part at least, as a product of our times. So we always look at why things happened when they did. Another thing my students or my children are going to put on my tombstone is the thing I like to say about what makes history what it is, and that is, why did it happen when it did? Things just don't happen, they happen in context, and they happen over time. They happen in times of chronology. The one thing that makes history what it is we deal with chronology. Things just don't leap up out of the blue, but they happen because they happen in a particular time. Why didn't we get a Billy Graham, let's say, in the 1920s? Why don't we get a Billy Graham in the 1980s, or somebody just like that? Obviously, to a degree, not that isn't the whole story. Historical context surely isn't the whole story, but historical context is important here. And I think one way to stand on common ground with Graham is to see him as a result of several important forces at work, all of which seem to coincide in one way or another around the year 1949 and 1950. And then to say, I think, if these things hadn't come together, these trends, these movements and forces hadn't happened in the way that they did, then Graham himself would never have been the, you know, the influence that he is. But I think this is a very sort of tangible, concrete way to start. People just don't, as I say, happen to sort of spring out of nowhere with this. We can, for instance, in looking at the historical background interpretation of Graham here, point, for instance, to the Cold War, which started, you remember, right after World War II, and say that in light of the fact that we had made these incredible sacrifices in World War II, we were going to make the world, you know, safe for democracy. You remember Churchill and Roosevelt's Four Freedoms and all these things. We really thought we had made this incredible sacrifice, and suddenly we were going to have the world go our way. Suddenly the Soviet Union came in and made the world go, you know, in an entirely different direction. And hence, some people thought that the great sacrifices of World War II were almost in vain because we faced just as big, if not a worse, enemy right after 1945 with VJ Day as we did before. So a lot of people were looking for assurances that God was still on the side of America, that we were doing the right things. That God was in the side of America against the battle of communists, and that therefore when influential and persuasive preachers came along and said those things, obviously Americans were looking for that kind of message. And Graham understood that rather early on in his ministry, as I'll give a couple of illustrations later. And hence, for those who were saying these sort of things, obviously there was a kind of response that was, that developed that Graham had intended. Or that's one way of looking at them, as I say, in historical context. Or we could say another one, and this is sort of the mass media interpretation. Some people attribute this to Marshall McLuhan. You remember that cliche? The message, the medium is the message. The medium is the message. It doesn't really matter so much what you say, it's how you say it. You know, between hot and cool, and they're having all kinds of fun with the Democratic convention from last week was Jackson hot and Ferrero cool and all these different things. Not the way teenagers mean those terms at all, but are they? You know, how do they project in the media? You can point out, we can point out that Graham, after all, is influential largely because of the mass media. He started with radio in the 1940s, television in the 1950s, the press, film strips, the movies that came forward. What was the? I'm trying to think of. There was always, you know, some new Billy Graham movie being distributed, and these have given him, you know, immense publicity. These have given him immense influence, and that's why he's newsworthy. And I think there's something to this interpretation. The media, for instance, likes to talk about people and likes to show people, you know, involved in expressing strong emotions. They like to show people involved in, you know, life-making decisions. There is a real feeling here that something's at work, and that is what holds, you know, and attracts our attention. We don't see the media, we don't see television, movies and all the rest doing very much, you know, with everyday life, the ordinary humdrum events of life. Some people object to this. But the best journalistic answer that I know of to why television and the media generally speak to, you know, the expression of strong feelings was made by Walter Cronkite, no less, here when some people had charged that the media was dealing only with the extraordinary and not with the ordinary things of life. And Cronkite's response was, well, How many of you are interested in knowing how many cats didn't run away today? What's the way Cronkite had of putting this? That is to say, Graham makes news because revivals make news. And hence, people can say he's the product, in a large part, to see the mass media. That's a second way of looking at him besides the historical context. Or third, we can say that Graham has his influence because of the kind of person that he is. And I want to develop this a little bit later. I just want to sort of lay out the options here as we go along. And here I draw from a book which I put on the board over here, which I think is the best biography of Graham, Marshall Frady. Simply Billy Graham, Little Brown, which is, I guess, Boston, 1982. And if you're interested in a very thorough and an extremely well-written biography, sometimes my fellow colleagues in church history write dreadfully, you know, bad prose. Frady himself is a Southern Baptist clergyman. He's a trained journalist, writes very, very well, and it's an enthralling kind of story. Somebody coming out of a dairy farm in rural North Carolina and becoming the best known, clergy spokesman for Protestantism in the world. It's just an extraordinary story. I want to talk about that a little bit later on. Anyway, this is what I would call the personality interpretation of Graham. Marshall Frady in this book thinks this is a clue. That is, Graham represents a type of person, if you like, a cluster of character traits, which we would like to believe is still strong and influential in American life today. Graham becomes something of a role model, in other words, for us. We like to think that Americans can still produce somebody like a Billy Graham. Frady points out over and over again that Graham is honestly very wholesome, dedicated, straightforward, unsophisticated. The kind of person that many of us, you know, not only admire, but probably in an unconscious sense, many of us ourselves would like to be. We know, for instance, to go a little further with a Frady interpretation here, from the study of mass movements, that in most cases, when you get a really strong, attractive mass movement, a movement grows and expands when it has a very attractive, dynamic leader. In the other sense of the word, a charismatic leader. Here, I'm going to be talking next week about the charismatic movement in the theological church sense, but a movement usually needs a strong, in this sense of the word, charismatic leader who exhibits the kinds of qualities which Frady says Graham has. Straightforward, dedicated, wholesome. He embodies or personifies, if you like, the ideals really of the movement himself. And there are no surprises, there are no landmines or booby traps or anything else or skeletons in the Billy Graham closet. That's another thing that's important. You know, the old cliche is true here, what you see is what you get. No surprises at all along this. To come back to the mass movement, the leader personifies the ideals and values of the movement. Hence, people join the movement because they find in that movement making up of the deficiencies which they find in their own life. They identify with this particular leader, and in that sense, their own lives take on the attributes or the qualities of this person. The leader is, you know, each of us human to be sure, but still writ large, a little bit more, a little bit stronger, a little bit more dedicated, a little bit more attractive in whatever sense of the word there is. We all have this in one way or another, role models, if you want to call them heroes, whatever the case might be, and how important that is for us. And you would say, and some people have said in our day and age, we're much more sophisticated. We're much, with all our new insights into psychology and mass movements and all the rest, that this should go away, that we don't have heroes. The way you remember when I grew up with Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, have you tried Wheaties and the best breakfast food in all the land and all those sort of things, and Captain Armstrong, no, it was Captain Midnight, right, and Tom Mix and Buck Rogers and all that this sort of thing would go away. But I think that hasn't gone away. If anything else, the media has made us even, and this is true with movies too, has made us even more, not necessarily dependent, but influenced by strong personalities, because as I remember one teacher told me, it's always stayed with me, nothing is more interesting than other people. All scientists can live with that if they want to, in one way or another, but nothing is more interesting than, not chemicals, but people. All right, anyway, let me put it in another way about mass movements and about Graham here. In American life today, which is changing so fast, what is it? They've got it down now that we more than double every 10 years the amount of information that we have available for this. So the amount of information, the information explosion is such that we more than double this. And if you read Nasbitt's book on megatrends, Nasbitt makes this very clear, that we are an informational society much more than a production kind of society. And I thought for a while of doing the Nasbitt thing here, but I think so many people have read it, it's been a national bestseller for, a couple of years. and which made me think that maybe so many of you have read it, we wouldn't have to discuss it that much further. All right. So many things are changing, information explosion, all the rest, but we want to hold fast to some things which are permanent, some things which you know, give our life meaning and direction. Because we're pulled in so many different kinds of directions. In a way, Holden is a microcosm of all the different things that are available for us and all the different places we can go. You know, if it's 10 o'clock, it's pottery. You know, just like if you're European tour, if it's Tuesday, it's Belgium. And, you know, all the rest that go along with that. But some people, you know, can't sort of live with this, and they want something a little more centered, so to speak. We can't take care of all the changes, the information explosion is one, in our own lives, in our own ways, so we join a movement, we join a crusade, something which millions of other people have joined. And in that way, we find ourselves part of something that unifies all these different ways in which we're pulled in so many different directions. By joining a movement, we find an explanation with clear principles as to what our lives are all about. And I think it's fair to say that this is growing rather than subsiding in our day. As I suggested before, I think we aren't as sophisticated as many of the critics seem we like to think we would be, because the 20th century, I think it's clear by all means, has seen more mass movements, both secular and religious, than any other century in all of history. When you stop to think of the Nazis, the communist movement, so many of the others, these are far more powerful than has ever been the case before. So what am I trying to say with Graham, looking at it from the standpoint of what common ground can we stand on in looking at him and assessing him, is that part of Graham's appeal, and part of it, if you take this kind of approach, is that he's been able to build his ministry on the needs of people, you know, for a crusade. I think that's fair to say without in any way criticizing or demeaning what's going on there. Fourth, I think with Graham, besides these other ones, his popularity stems from the fact that he stands for what I would call a combination of traditional, familiar, conservative theology. For one thing, I think that's one thing it's you know, the old or older, more traditional kind of theology instead of some of the new ones. You remember, whatever happened to God is dead? You remember the 1960s? Or it got to be the theology of this or the theology of that, or everything was post this or post that for a long time. Harvey Cox wrote The Secular City in 1965, published it in 1965, and now in his latest book in 1984, that was a great, strong liberal theology. Now, 1984, his new book, Religion and the Secular City, he's repudiated most of the secular of the liberal theology which he had at that particular time, and it doesn't bother old Harv at all because he goes with the flow, and he has a very strong personal Baptist faith, which a lot of people don't quite understand. But he was a very trendy kind of theologian, and I've got to get back my notes so I know what I'm talking about. Okay, Graham represents, first of all, a loyalty to a sort of anti-trendy approach in theology. You can take this to an extreme. This isn't Graham, but it's one story, you know, you love to tell with a new audience. And in Princeton Theological Seminary in the 19th century was extremely, to put it mildly, conservative. While Yale and Harvard and Union and some of the others went off, Chicago went off in different directions. And the president of Princeton Theological Seminary, Charles Hodge, said at the end of his 50-year stay there, both as a teacher and as an administrator, he said it in a complimentary sense, he said, there wasn't one new idea that was ever introduced into Princeton Theological Seminary in 50 years. And he meant that as a compliment. They weren't going to do any of these newfangled sort of things at all. And, he had kept the door shut for new ideas in 50 years. Okay. So he has this, Graham has this loyalty to conservative theology. He has a strong loyalty to America, to American patriotism, which you don't often find coming, you know, from American pulpits. And he also has a loyalty to a very strict personal code of conduct in a time when all of these, you see, seem to be coming loose, so far as some Americans are concerned. And this is a remarkable kind of achievement. Without asking for it, to take that a little bit further here, without asking for it, Graham has become the spokesman for those millions of Americans who want to see America as still representing the closest thing, you see, to an expression of God's will on earth. The idea going way back to the original Puritans, you remember John Winthrop on his message to the Puritans in 1630, that America should be the city on a hill, the shining city on a hill for all the world to see. Americans still want to believe, and they want to believe even after the traumas of Watergate, for instance, in Vietnam, that America still is sound and America still is good at heart, that we still are the city on the hill for all the world to see. that we are a generous, dedicated, disciplined people who seek to follow God's will in our national of our life. Graham appeals very strongly to this, and has done so throughout his throughout his career. Americans still want to believe, to use Lincoln's famous expression, that America still is the last best hope of earth. And Graham has understood this, and for him, if you want to call it the American dream, you know, the log cabin to White House sort of thing, the log cabin to White House sort of dream has come true, coming from rural North Carolina and becoming so prominent, has made this sort of a reality for him, just as it did for Lincoln, coming from the log cabin, you remember, in Kentucky to the White House itself with us. So Graham embodies these particular kinds of virtues, and I think those would be some of the reasons, and I want to develop these in some detail now, why I think that Graham is as popular and has such longevity in American life. Because Americans are notorious for what we call the consumer society, or sometimes the consumptionist society. We like something, we use it, and we throw it away. You notice just at Holden, for one thing here, you don't have pop cans. The only way you can get any pop is in a glass, which you can use again. And you don't even, I remember John Tram was the one, the old timers here can remember, John was the one who put that in, John and Mary, that there is so much of our throwaway kind of society. We use something and throw away. Built-in obsolescence is what I'm trying to, the term I'm trying to, find here. And you would think that in mass media, or in sports heroes, or in, television heroes, or television personalities, whatever happened to Jack Parr, would be a good example of this, that we would have by this time thrown away or discarded somebody like Billy Graham. Who's the latest? What's the latest trend and all the rest? Not so with Billy Graham. He's had remarkable staying power for a long period of time. Okay. Now, looking at some of the, you might call them some of the more critical interpretations or evaluations of him, there are those who argue that his popularity and influence, you see, is explained largely by the fact that his organization is really just that, so well organized. It uses the most sophisticated means of advertising, of promotion, of financing. And that given that combination of skill in technology with all the latest updated technology and machines, computers, all the rest of these things, that it's which are patterned after American advertising, for instance, and all the rest, that it's no wonder that he's so successful, that the combination really, in a sense, couldn't miss being so influential. Or some other people have put it in a slightly different way. Isn't there a danger in the preaching of the gospel and the attempt to winning converts to conduct the revivals in the way that Billy Graham does? As the question here, which is raised, and I want to go into this in a little bit of detail. What I would invite you to do, if you're ever in Minneapolis, is to go to the Graham headquarters. It's about 1313, for sure, it's the Grayson Bookstore, 1313 Hennepin Avenue, and if you're wondering, is that part of Minneapolis safe, I would say maybe, because down at, 10th and Hennepin has the highest crime rate, I think, for muggings and all the rest, of any place in the Twin Cities. And Graham wasn't afraid of putting his association, in a tough part of town. I think that's fair to say. He didn't build a college on a hill or something, way out isolated from the rest of the world. But anyway, the Graham organization, BGEA, Billy Graham Evangelical Association, is a superbly organized, very smoothly run, highly efficient, carefully planned enterprise. One interesting statistic, it has so much mail, it has its own zip code. Not even 3M, not even Pillsbury, not even Honeywell, the other giants in the Twin Cities, General Mills, not even the rest of them have their own zip code. Billy Graham gets more mail than any other place in the Twin Cities. They have some wonderful, quaint expressions. Somebody, Billy Graham, many apples, Minnesota. Some people sometimes maybe a little hard of hearing, and all the rest, probably can't read too clearly if they don't have, the big, enlarged glasses on when he comes in the tube right in there. So if you go inside, what I'm saying is this. When you go inside, you will see how proud the workers are of their operations. They have a guided tour which shows you the mail, the extensive computers, the media production equipment, which makes the tapes, the movies, the pamphlets, and publishes the newspaper decision and all the rest. And this takes money, this takes a good deal of money. And that money is put into making the most out of the means of promotion, these means of promotion which are so popular with the group. In other words, some critics argue that the Graham Association has become too slick, too smooth. It is run as a business, while the real calling of the evangelist, they say, should be given to more simple one-to-one kinds of activities. The BGEA, or Graham Association, has been criticized for placing such tremendous emphasis on numbers, as one example here. The Graham Association will send you a list of the numbers of people who have been to every rally since Graham became popular or well-known in 1949. The list will show how many decisions have been made, or how many people have answered the altar call, how many who did come forward hadn't already been baptized, or who had been backsliders, or who came forward as a means of rededicating their lives to Christ. Some critics say this gives the impression that the association is preoccupied with numbers, rather than concentrating on, you know, individual seekers. Graham answers this by saying that with all these numbers, if only one sinner is converted to Christ in all of the programs the association has, then the whole effort will have been worth it. Yet, I submit also with the critics here that there is something of a risk. Okay. Others argue that the crusade rallies, the meetings, for instance, we see on television, or maybe some of you have been at, you said you went to the one in the kingdom. And I remember going to one remarkable one. I remember 1950, right, I was a sophomore at St. Olaf, and I'd come from a very strict Lutheran tradition. Terry Fredon has no monopoly on coming from a Haugianer tradition from mine. And we had learned about these revivalists, and there hadn't been much good to be said for revivalists in that part of the country. But anyway, I really liked this one girl. She was a sophomore too, Donna Mae Simonson, and she wanted to go to a Billy Graham revival up at the Minneapolis Auditorium. And so I went. And more to impress Donna Mae than anything else. It didn't do any good in the long run, the first thing I was impressed with was it was in the early May in a torrential downpour. And we got there, guess what, we got there early. And something I'd never seen back in the churches back in my home around Kenyon. And people were standing waiting for the doors to open, torrential downpour, and they were singing Heavenly Sunshine. such a display of emotion back from my Norwegian Lutheran friends would have been cause for calling the people in the nets and the white suits. I was telling a couple of you this old line some of you must have heard about the Norwegian farmer who loved his wife so much he almost told her. You can tell yours a little bit later. That's one of my all-time. I give credit where credit due. That's Phil Hansen, who does a lot of counseling at Northwestern Abbott in Minneapolis. That's one of Phil's best lines. Okay, so credit where credit is due. Okay. Anyway, I knew something was different, and Donna Mae asked me to come forward that night, and I couldn't do it. I didn't really understand in theological terms what was at stake here, the difference between, the Lutheran tradition and, let's say, the Baptist tradition about being born again and instant conversion versus what I'll call the nurture tradition. But at least it was my first exposure to this sort of thing. Now, people will say that the crusade rallies, the meetings we see on television, are too carefully staged. They're manipulative. They rely on the knowledge we have of how to motivate people to do something, through various kinds of devices, through hymns, soft lights, or the argument which is put forward that if you don't come forward tonight, you might be killed in a car accident on the way home, appealing to fear here rather than to faith, and that one has been done. Okay. Is all this with the lights and all the rest in harmony with, the Great Commission of Matthew 28? You see here why some questions are being raised. Another question that's being raised isn't Graham taking away money, resources, and in a sense loyalty from the local congregation? Is Graham drawing money away from and support away from places, from sources, places which should send it actually to the local congregations? Next week I want to talk about the electronic church, people like Jimmy Swaggart and Jerry Falwell, the PTL Club, and all the rest of these. And the question can be raised, although Graham comes on only, every quarter, that's right, four times a year. He doesn't want overexposure. The same thing is true with Oral Roberts. It's only twice a year with him because they recognize now that you can be burned out on television with overexposure. My own feeling, if it's a preview, that Jim and Tammy Baker burned out about 10 years ago, but that's my own personal reaction to them. Okay. Hasn't Graham, as some people have said, created a new church, a new denomination, which takes people's resources and energies away from the local parish? Aren't the local congregations hurting enough already for financial support not to have to compete with something as strong as a BGEA organization, which has such great machinery for sending out, its fundraising appeals? Let me give you one example. One joy of living, and I mean this in all sincerity, of living in Northfield, in doing research in this area is being able to talk about once or twice a year to the retired Northfield Pastors Association. That's one thing, one of the many Lutheran ministers love, you know, like elephants know where to go to die. They like to come to Northfield to retire in the shadow of the hill, and so on. And they have their association, which I consider it a real privilege to be invited to address. And I got talking about Billy Graham one day, and it was old Reverend Froyland. I don't know if any of you, that rings a bell with some of you, passed on about 10 years ago. And I got talking about Graham doing the sort of thing I'm doing here, and Froyland had been in the pastorate for about 40 years. And I was talking about Graham, and he spoke up, and I can't do the Norwegian accent the way he did. It adds a little flavor to it. But he said this: yes, some of us work hard in the fields for years and years, and then in a twinkling of an eye, someone else comes along and reaps all the harvest. He wasn't all that impressed with the work he had done with nurture, and then suddenly the instant conversion thing comes along and it was all gone. Okay. Graham would answer that, Reverend Froyland, by saying his is only one very specialized form of ministry. The people who answer the altar calls are given referral cards, as many of you know, to find out whether they belong to a church or what denominations they would like to belong to, if any, or what kind of organizational preference they have. These cards are sent to the appropriate local bodies, and then these churches are free to do what they want with this information about those who answered the altar call. In other words, Graham suggests his ministry is simply to launch people towards participation in the churches. After he's done that, the future of the seeker is in the hands of the local congregation. Sometimes that was that's been misunderstood, but that's, you know, the point he would make there. All right. Now, the point of controversy, though, that comes in is not so much that Graham is in competition with the local congregation, which I don't think is the case, but there is a controversy here, is that many people come forward, obviously, and many of those who do come forward don't last. And people have wondered, you know, why that should be the case. One answer is given, that is that those who come forward and then drop out have been given insufficient information or counseling as to what to expect once they have come forward, and you know, what steps should be taken next. Then many expect that their religious lives will be close to that very exciting moment, the peak exhilaration, you know, the hour I first believed, that they felt when they came forward. And when they come to a parish, they find something a lot different from, you know, the hour I first believed. And you all have your own horror stories of what's going on in your local parishes about this. I always knew my brother is a pastor in Tucson. When he'd had an especially rough time with his board, there would be a call, "Erling, I just can't handle it anymore," you know, and so on. All right, when they come to the parish, they find something a lot different from what they had already experienced. And all of you can, I'm sure, remember the first time you came back after Bible camp, and you came back to Kenyon or Elbow Lake or wherever it might be, and people just weren't all that excited, you know, about what had happened, and you began to wonder, why aren't they more excited? This is what the church is supposed to be. Or I had a marvelous experience in 1949. It was the Lutheran Student Association ashram in Interlochen, Michigan, and Maury Wee was at his absolute best at that time. And just, I had a chance a couple of years ago to refresh, you know, our memories together with Maury, and he considered that one of his great experiences in his life, too. We came back, and, you know, the arguments, you know, in the churches were not what we had been led to expect, you know, what would be going on there. Okay, so you see the point. There's a larger question here, obviously at stake, and one which we can't settle now, but is mass revivalism the best way to introduce people to the Christian faith? It puts so much emphasis, you see, on the moment of instant conversion. Of course, as I said, this is a long-standing controversy in the church. When you look back at people who had instant conversion experiences, it's pretty impressive. Paul, St. Augustine, Luther talks about his tower experience, if some of you remember. And it's in Bacon's book about the tower experience, and that wasn't when he threw the inkwell at Satan, but he talks about a tower experience. John Wesley, you know, my heart strangely warmed at Aldergate Chapel, the Methodist emphasis there. That's a fairly impressive list of people who have had these kinds of experiences. That's one way of doing it. The other way of looking at it, of course, is coming to faith should be a matter of slow, steady nurture. Sometimes this is called the nurture-nature argument, you know, in church development. Slow, steady nurture of growth, of ups and downs, recognition of our many failures even after we've made a commitment. There is a danger in the kind of, you know, mass evangelism we're talking about today, because it might create the impression that in calling it to being born again, we can really change the kind of persons that we are. That's really the theological issue at stake here. Does anything really qualitatively happen in our, you know, in our natures at this point? Graham, in his book, How to Be Born Again, says we do gain a new nature. He said we are different persons. But I can remember my old huggy background, and then it showed up in the Red Book. You remember in the liturgy, we are by nature sinful and unclean. Wherefore we flee for refuge, you know, to thine infinite mercy. And I'm glad the Green Book changed that. I just don't like the by nature sinful and unclean sort of thing, but it was stayed in Lutheranism a long, long time. Nobody has, you know, more of a monopoly on guilt, I think, than Lutherans. Graham argues, you see, that that is changed at, you know, the hour we first believe. And it is it. Luther says, you know, on the other hand, we daily drown the old Adam. I think, you know, that's the answer. We're just as much a sinner the day we die as the day we had our conversion experience, such as it is. Okay. Now, another point, and it's just a small one with mine, but I like to get it out of my system every so often, is with Graham, sometimes I think the wrong or certainly a misleading impression is given so far as the role models are concerned that are put forward on the two. This is true not only with Graham, but it's true with the Holy Electronic Church itself. Well, the testimonials, the witnesses of celebrities, famous public officials. I was going to say Miss America, but I better not say that anymore. I'm sure she won't probably be on the next crusade rally, but anyway, or famous athletes or coaches, Tom Landry, or political figures, John Connolly, and I figured I'm glad to see John Connolly on Billy Graham River Revival, because I know something about his background in Texas politics, and he needed all the help he could get. Okay. For instance, have you ever seen a homely or a plain singer? All the people there are so wholesome, so nice, or so attractive. I personally would prefer the testimonial at a Graham rally of a plain, everyday citizen than I would of a famous celebrity. Graham, as I talked about earlier this week, got burned after his association with Nixon on Watergate, and some of that has been modified since that happened. What I am saying here is that sometimes we get the impression that just because a person is famous and a celebrity, that they aren't just as big sinners as all the rest of us are. Sometimes I'm wondering about the kind of role models that are put forward to show the rest of the world what it means, to be a Christian. I was delighted to see that Jeannie Erickson, the paraplegic, has been on the Billy Graham revivals, and I think that's a very positive step, in the right direction. Okay, when I was talking to Jeff Amott, the carpenter here, and if he gets off, makes a mistake in shingling, which he's doing now, it'll show up forever. And I make a mistake, what the heck, I just back up and start over again. Okay. It has to be said, and I was saying that for Graham, it has to be said on the other hand, when you think of the electronic church, Billy Graham doesn't wear a pink tuxedo when he has his revival meetings. There are no gushing waterfalls or meetings in the upper room or hard sell. What was that one? I won't give my personal physical reaction to it, but with Jim Baker, you start living when you start giving to the Lord. And it was as hard sell hucksterism, as I've ever seen in my life. And all the men in the pink tuxedos, and the women with a slightly dipping neckline, and the blow-dried hair, and all the rest of these things. Nothing like that at all with Graham. It's a straightforward, good old Cliff Barrows is out there. He doesn't have his trombone anymore. It's kind of too bad. Remember the Cliff Barrows trombone, and he would conduct with the trombone and play at the same time. Right. That sort of old Southern Baptist tent meeting sawdust trail kind of thing is gone. They're much more, I kind of liked it. I was trying to think of that one about how God uses trombones. There was this famous poem about it. Anyway, but there are no spectacular light shows, no secular gimmicks in the Billy Graham revivals. Okay, so is mass revivalism the way in which the gospel is best preached with this? Okay, I would only ask, is it the best way? Now, another problem, of course, with Graham is that for a long time he avoided what we would call major social, political, economic questions of the time. He concentrated on bringing people to conversion, to the moment when people were called forward. And also, and quite rightly, some people have criticized him for this, but I would certainly support it, he didn't get involved in the very controversial theological issues. He himself is Southern Baptist, but you don't hear him talking about infant baptism versus adult baptism, because that's such a controversial issue. Or over the meaning of the Eucharist. Is it a memorial service, the transubstantiation, a real presence? or church organization, or what we call polity? Should it be from the top down, or should it be from the bottom up, as it is with Baptist churches, or with congregational churches, or all the rest of these things? He quite rightly avoided those, although some people wanted him to do that, because he argued we're here to bring people together, not to find people and then say, aha, what divides you? Once you've got people, you know, together in an auditorium, in an arena, whatever the case might be. But what has happened to Graham, and he talks about this freely, is that in the last few years he's gotten much more directly involved in the major social, political, economic issues of the time. Graham, about 2 years ago, got directly involved in calling for arms control. He supported the nuclear freeze, for instance, among other things, and is taken a good deal of criticism for this, but nevertheless, his ministry is such that has led him into this, you know, this particular kind of approach. And I think that is a part of one last thing I want to say about it, and then we'll have time for discussion here. It comes from a realization that revivals are always, you know, in his way of thinking, necessary and in order and have their place, but that there are certain kinds of limitations to what revivals can accomplish. Because if you look back on the history of revivals in America, the earlier revivals, the First Great Awakening and then the Second, and then Moody's, Billy Sundays and all the rest, really aimed at, you know, converting America, or converting a whole city, or converting, you know, a whole state, whatever the case might be. They really believed that there was going to be, in, you know, their terms, a plentiful outpouring of the power of the Holy Spirit, and that everybody would be caught up in this, and that we could, you know, bring America back to God again, as was the case. Graham started off in 1949 believing that very strongly, that revival could be such that you could win a whole nation, a whole people over to God. And he started off believing this, you know, with his whole heart. He started with his famous 1949 revival in Los Angeles, where he said that, this was right after the Russians had detonated their first atomic bomb, he said that Russia had three atomic bombs, and he said that one was for New York City, one was for Chicago, and the third one was for Los Angeles. Well, as it turned out, the maid of William Randolph Hearst, who was the grandfather of Patty, if you're interested, in the great newspaper publisher, she was, the maid heard this and went back and told her employer, Mr. Hearst, about what had happened, and he sent a telegram to all the Hearst papers across the country. It's a journalistic term, it's puff or expand Graham, give him maximum publicity. When people, you know, preachers start talking about, you know, dropping atomic bombs on Los Angeles, that's news. And Graham got on the front pages, and then a couple of weeks later, Henry Luce, who was publisher, member of Time Life, and he was a preacher's kid, he was a missionary's kid from China, very deeply, you know, concerned Christian himself, found this young, energetic, attractive revivalist and gave him attention. And Graham, I remember, was on the cover of Life magazine in the space of a few weeks. And the momentum started to go, and Graham, for a long time, this is what I'm getting at, thought this was evidence that he was being called to save America, not just to have a revival for some people here, or a state there, or a congregation somewhere else. And continued in that mode until 1957, when he was confident that the Lord can do great things. He can even save New York City, Manhattan, the famous Manhattan Crusade. Well, to skip the details here, it failed, made no dent at all, and in 1958, whatever the religious peak of the 1950s had achieved had started to slip by that time, and by 1960, Graham started to change his tactics, and where he concentrated and concentrates now not so much on some sort of entity such as America or the American people or something else like that, but he concentrates on individuals and concentrates on that other particular kind of approach, and realizes that Christianity has been expanded out to where it includes a far wider range of interests and problems than had been on his agenda back in the 1950s. And I think that's basically what I would like to say, and we've got about 15 minutes, maybe a little bit less, for comments, responses, you know, from you. Yeah, Bunker.
Is there any movement afoot as proving something to take his place?
I'm a Graham watcher. Like yesterday, I was on a moon watcher too, but I'm a Graham watcher, and for a long time they thought it was his son-in-law, Leighton Ford. And Ford does do sort of smaller revivals. If Graham goes to Chicago, Leighton Ford goes to Springfield. I suppose if Graham goes to Minneapolis,
waiting for it may go to Hibbing, just to pick off one, he can land at the Hibbing International Airport, one of my favorite places. But anyway, you know, Leighton Ford, but then that hasn't happened yet. Or there's the one John Wesley White, who's sort of about the number three evangelist, who does, he's mainly in Canada, John Wesley White. But nobody has really come forward yet. And what's fascinating, I'll talk about this next week, what's fascinating is that Jerry Falwell is trying very hard to move into the ground that Graham has occupied for the last 25, 30 years.
I was going
to
ask.
Yeah. Graham, Falwell wants to be Mr. Responsible Conservative Protestant spokesman for the country. He doesn't say things anymore like God doesn't hear the prayers of a Jew. You know, that one is back in the closet for historians to study now. You know, other things like that. Graham, and he's on all, you know, Phil Donahue all the other talk shows and trying very hard to do that. He was out in San Francisco, you know, getting a lot of television coverage, and flies around the country all the time trying to do that. And some people aren't going to let him do that.
Have you been watching Billy Graham? What would you classify as possibly his greatest achievement, and where would you say his greatest downfall?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know about the downfall. I'll leave that, you know, some of the comments I've made that I think my own, maybe it's from my own personal standpoint, but I think sometimes people have been led with revivalism, maybe because they haven't had counseling or whatever it is, to expect the wrong things from religion, or from religious faith, or from conversion experience. The wonderful things, you know, that never happened to me, although I did feel better, some of you know my interest in Garrison Keillor. He had a wonderful sequence once on the kids coming home from Bible camp with Reverend Enquist, you remember? Suddenly life in Lake Wobegon just absorbed these kids again altogether. That was a part of Graham, of Keillor's growing up. That's the way life is. Life isn't on top of the mountain place, mountaintop all the time where you sing Kumbaya and all the other with the fireplace and your dedication sort of thing. But the greatest thing, certainly, he's made Protestantism, I think, a viable option for a large number of people who might otherwise simply never have even heard about it before, I think, or has brought it to a position where people will have to come to some sort of terms with it. He's shown, I think, that it's durable, and it, in certain instances, can make new responses, like with the arms control sort of thing, I think. And he's, for instance, in the 1950s, he was an old tub-thumping, flag-waving patriot, the chauvinistic kind of type, and I think that's been modified to some degree. But he's kept, I think, evangelical Protestantism alive in a time when it'd be very easy to become sophisticated and cynical about it, because especially all our greater, isn't religion just, you know, really a yearning, as Freud said, you know, for a father image, or isn't it just wishful thinking? Wouldn't it be great to have some father who takes care of you and will take care of all your problems someday? And you know, and Graham has shown that it is directly related, I think, in a much more profound way to the everyday problems of life than might have been the case somewhere else. So he's accepted that kind of responsibility and has, you know, as I've suggested at the beginning, given up any sort of sense of personal privacy, you know, for that. I would think that would be his greatest contribution.
You believe then that he is sincere?
Oh, yeah.
Personal
yeah.
life and everything
yeah.
is definitely
yeah.
sincere.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Frady makes this point very clearly.
There isn't any phony.
No, there's nothing. Some people, you know, deal on the edges. The big word is adiaphora here with some things. Maybe, who is it, George Wilson, his business manager, maybe he drives a Cadillac. To that I would say, you know, big deal. It's not important. I mean, if you have to deal with the extras or the fringes sort of thing, that's not important. I think it's, you know, Graham's central message is where he either stands or falls. Yeah, I don't know. No, there's no question that he really is this way. Had, for instance, for a long while, I could start telling other kinds of stories, but yeah, I would let it go.
That's undoubtedly one of his big deals.
Yeah, that's the whole thrust of Frady's book, is he calls him a man of righteousness. Yeah.
How old is he?
He's over 65. He was born in, let's see, no, I can, no, I'm sorry. I can figure out quickly here, 1917 is when he was born.
Graham
is kind of 67, yeah. 17 is when he was born, yeah.
Has kind of become the elder statesman.
Yes, he's very much the elder statesman. And Ford, I don't know if Ford is, Leighton Ford is waiting for him, or John Wesley White is waiting for the formal retirement. For a while, they thought Graham's son might be the candidate. But Graham's son now has taken over the direction of the Billy Graham Library at Wheaton College. I was there for a conference last year. And a remarkable young man, and that's, you know, he realizes the pressures of being a son of a celebrity, and that's all he wants. But Graham is very much the elder statesman.
What?
Yeah, lots of
you,
things.
You mentioned the early Graham mm-hmm. murder is great, da 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 da. And now you mentioned that he had sort of come out. How does he relate now to the guys like Jerry Falwell and all the other?
Yeah,
what's his America's Great thing?
In a way, it's like his decision not to talk about controversial theology. He'd rather talk about things that unite people. But he was critical of the moral majority's involvement in politics in the hit list and the moral report card, for instance, in 1980. He was quite critical of that, and it was fairly clear where he stood on those things. He wasn't like the American Civil Liberties Union in their reaction to the moral majority. But I think it was, if you understood his language, I think it was clear that he stayed clear of that sort of thing. Yeah. So he's got amazing survival powers, just incredible survival powers, and has developed a sense of loyalty. Yeah, I thought I saw. Yeah, there we go.
I think Pia's movement is going to be very critical of instant conversions.
Yeah.
But I think we also have to face the fact that if evangelism was left up to Lutherans, that heaven would be an empty place.
Yeah, well, that's why I mentioned Paul and Saint Augustine, the famous garden conversion. And Luther and John Wesley as examples, yeah.
Do you see the charismatic movement in competition to the evangelical kind of thing? How do they relate?
Yeah. Boy.
next week,
yeah, I've got a tape and my book is out of print, so I can't on this, so I can't say that I'm promoting my own book on this, but I talk some about that in that. Some, it depends on the individual. Some people see no particular conflict at all, and some evangelicals see the charismatic movement as an attempt to sort of add new revelation to the scripture. Because if with speaking in tongues, people were saying they believe they're receiving a new, fresh, message or direction or imperative, whatever it is, from God. And with the tongues, and they'll have the interpretation and explain that. And many evangelicals and almost all fundamentalists, and Falwell is very much opposed, for instance, to the charismatic movement, and then Pat Robertson is in favor of it, so, back and forth. But some evangelicals will say, well, by getting a tongue, you are claiming that you are getting new revelation, and all we need is what's in already in the 66 books. For instance, some of you know one Missouri Lutheran pastor, Don Fortenauer, was kicked out of the Missouri church for that exact reason. The Missouri hierarchy simply refused to believe that Don wasn't claiming that he was getting additional revelation. That would be where I think the real source of tension between evangelicals and charismatics exists, where it does exist. And some evangelicals think that the charismatic thing is much too emotional.
I guess that's what I was thinking of with my question, that the evangelicals or the Billy Graham revival kind of thing seems to create an awful lot of emotion.
Yep.
Which certainly wasn't part of my, I wasn't a Haugian, but it sure wasn't part of my Lutheran heritage. And it seems that the charismatics really groove on emotion too.
Yeah, there's been a strong modification, I think, in some respects. I was floored here 1 year. I was doing this thing here in 78 on charismatics, and there was a group of charismatic Lutherans from Davis, California, a parish, and they said something. They wished that people who had just come into the charismatic movement, had what they like to call the second baptism, they wished that those people could be put in deep freeze for 6 months to calm down some of the enthusiasm that comes with that. I was surprised that charismatics would say that. Yeah.
If you want to read something interesting, which you probably already have, but read the Fox Fire.
Yeah, Fire.
Is it six or seven? The one that's totally religion. And it's...
Oh, Fox Fire, yeah.
It's people, it's mountain religion, and there you get, it's all these old 80-year-old mountain guys talking about their religious experiences, and you can see the 100-year-old antagonisms between the Pentecostal and
the evangelical. Right. Yeah. Graham himself was open to the charismatic movement, but never fully endorsed it. Yeah, and has stayed by that position. He's got a book on the Holy Spirit that came out right when the charismatic movement was popular. And it's traditional Orthodox teaching on the Holy Spirit, right? But I've got time for lunch. And I'll be glad to meet you under the bell. We're a little early, leaving, but...